So continuing this morning, chapter 32, out of 33 chapters in the whole canto, nearing the conclusion. Entanglement in fruit of activities. Entanglement in fruit of activities. Sound familiar? Entanglement in fruit of activities. You don't do fruit of activities, do you? No. Fruit of activities is not just having a job versus, you know, not having a job or being homeless. Like a homeless person doesn't, they're detached. They don't have fruit of activities. They have fruit of activities. It's the nature of being in contact with Prakriti. We're in contact with Prakriti because of the mode of passion we want to enjoy through material nature. So some like to enjoy according to different modes and mixture of the modes. That the implication in matter is the spirit of enjoyment independent of Krishna, that's fruit of activities. So how do you do a U-turn? How do you get away from fruit of activities implicated in matter, in the modes of nature and karma and the self-perpetuating machine of continuing birth and death involvement in matter? The answer is bhakti. And so this, as I mentioned yesterday, the beginning part of this chapter, which is where we are now, it's a compare and contrast. That is, living entities, whether they're in the renounced order or in household life, there's spirit can be interested in being an enjoyer of material nature, of gross or subtle kind, or being interested in self-realization and God-realization, and fulfilling necessities in that consciousness, Krishna consciousness. So the first four verses were the Grihamedi elements, and now we're going to hear the Grihastha elements. Some were presented, at least in the purport, Prabhupada was making that distinction. So now, starting with text 5, Kapila Dev says, those who are intelligent and are of purified consciousness are completely satisfied with an in Krishna consciousness. Freed from the modes of material nature, they do not act for sense gratification. Rather, since they are situated in their own occupational duties, they act as one is expected to act. That's a symptom of the mode of goodness. Going back to chapter 29, this is 32. Chapter 29, it's in relation to devotional service. The beginning question is, Devahuti wants to know, devotional service is pure. You described that in chapter 28, so now beginning 29. Is it possible that although devotional service is pure, that there can be a mixture with the modes of nature? So, yes, devotional service is pure, but one's consciousness may not be pure, even in contact with devotional service. So there's devotional service influenced by ignorance, passion, goodness, transcendence. So there's the mode of goodness, as this verse is indicating. The mode of goodness is where one does something, you could say it either one of two ways, because it is to be done. It's duty. You do because you're to do. like, you know, you speak the truth because you were supposed to speak the truth. You don't speak lies. You speak the truth. You don't steal another's property. You allow another to have their property because you don't steal. You're honoring the property of others. It's, you know, like the first verse of Ishopanishad says that. You can accept that which is your quota and not even touch anything else because it belongs to someone else. Ultimately, it belongs to Isha, to the Supreme. So you take that which is your quota and don't take beyond what is your quota. If something comes, you distribute it for service unto the Supreme. Don't be miserly. Don't hoard and gather and collect and do that program. That's another mode. So the mode of goodness is, it's not specified. The first part of the verse says free from the modes of nature, but the second part is engaging in devotional service because it's ought to be done. I'll read it again. Free from the modes of nature, they do not act for sense gratification. So acting for sense gratification, what mode of nature is that? Mode of passion. So if the mode of passion isn't active, then its corollary, the mode of ignorance, will not be active. That doesn't mean you're yet in the fully transcendental position. That is, they're not active. The mode of goodness is active means the mode of passion and the mode of ignorance are subordinate or not active. Rather, since they are situated in their own occupational duties, they act as one is expected to act. They act out of duty. So the mode of goodness, back to chapter 29, mode of goodness is one performs something because it is to be done. Or, similar, one performs something because it will bring purification. So something is to be done because it will bring purification. Things are not to be done because it brings contamination. So mode of goodness. It is to be done, it brings purification. So we should, the message, practical application part is, we should take up our services in that mood. We should do things, we should, you know, rise early in the morning and everything else, the activities of bhakti, because they're to be done. I mean, some of them are pretty obvious. You take a bath, or you brush your teeth, or, and then, you know, the other things, we put on tilak, you know. It doesn't, if you don't put on tilak, it's not that you get spanked. But we do because it's meant to remind us of Krishna and it sanctifies the body and so forth. So we do those things because they're purifying and they're regulated and we're lifted and protected from the lower modes of nature by observing Dharma. Dharma rakshata, rakshataha. Raksha means protection. The one who protects Dharma is protected by Dharma. It's a nice rule. And it works. You're protected from degradation by observing Dharma. So the indication is not to do the Dharma so you get some perks. So then you can be an enjoyer of the perks of the fruits of piety. That's passion. Not for that motive, but because it ought to be done, the mode of goodness motive. And by that's the occupational duty part. That's, you know, in the involvement in matter part of our life. It's very nice. Purport. The first class example of this type of man is Arjuna. Arjuna was a Kshatriya, and his occupational duty was to fight. Generally, kings fight to extend their kingdoms which they rule for sense gratification. But as far as Arjuna is concerned, he declined to fight for his own sense gratification. He said that although he would get a kingdom by fighting with his relatives, he did not want to fight with them. But when he was ordered by Krishna and convinced by the teachings of Bhagavad Gita that his duty was to satisfy Krishna, then he fought. Thus he fought not for his sense gratification, but for the satisfaction of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Detached work, karma palatyag, karma nevadikaraste ma paleshu kadachana. You're entitled to perform your prescribed duty, but not to the pala. So don't do the duty so that you get something. You do the duty because it's to be done. It will purify. It will protect Dharma. You're protected by Dharma. Same message. Paragraph. Persons who work at their prescribed duties, not for sense gratification, but for gratification of the Supreme Lord, are called nisanga. Freed from the influence of the modes of material nature, nyasta karmanaha. Nyasta karmanaha indicates that the results of their activities are given to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Such persons appear to be acting on the platform of their respective duties, but such activities are not performed for personal sense gratification. Rather, they're performed for the Supreme Person. He's like said it four times already. Different language, but repeated message. Such devotees are called prashantaha, which means, quote, completely satisfied. Shuddha chetasa means Krishna conscious, semicolon. Their consciousness has become purified. In unpurified consciousness, one thinks of himself as the Lord of the universe, but in purified consciousness, one thinks of himself the eternal servant of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Putting oneself in that position of eternal servitorship to the Supreme Lord and working for him perpetually, one actually becomes completely satisfied. As long as one works for his personal sense gratification, he will always be full of anxiety. That is the difference between ordinary consciousness and Krishna consciousness. You see how he's doing the compare and contrast, juxtaposing these two models. And of course, the distinction of these models gets a little bit blurred in the course of, you know, mixed devotional service, which we're very familiar with, where the modes of nature are still operating, and even we may get a clear idea and take a step or two or three or ten, shortly thereafter we're back in the modes. Our steadiness in devotional service is not yet achieved, because there's forces acting within us that we're attracted to or conditioned by. The devotional service is not yet sufficiently strong. And so covered or mixed. Is there some indication that this is sadhana bhakti being described here? It's not bhava bhakti or prema bhakti. It's Kapila is outlining to Devahuti how to go beyond the conditioning influences So part of it is to be very clear, this is this and that is that, and to choose this instead of that, and then practice. The focus of the discussion is upon fruitive activities or implication in matter, and how do you deal with that? Again, it's not just whether you have a job or you don't have a job. Students and brahmacharis and others may similarly have fruitive tendency doing because you want to get, rather than simply making some offering to the personality of Godhead. It's subtle, and therefore it's elusive, especially when we start, you know, leave the classroom discussion and start doing things. I think one of the classic questions, paraphrased in different ways or expressed in different ways, but one person in New Jersey, he's saying, I get Krishna consciousness up, except for 9 to 5. I mean, I get the morning program and the evening program, and it's like, fine, I love it. But when I sit down at 9 o'clock, it's like that switches off, and at 5 o'clock, and it happens every day. I wonder what happened. My Krishna consciousness just, the relatability of everything just disappeared. Because I had, I paid attention to the work that was given to me, and the thought of Krishna just disappeared. So how do you do it? And that same question asked in different ways, it's a standard question, and what's being said here is not unstated in Bhagavad Gita. It's Bhagavad Gita's message as well. But how to, so there's spirit, there's matter, and there's the controller of both. That's three of the five topics. And then there's time, and there's activity. So how to engage in activity pushed by time and influenced by the modes of nature? How do we get out of that entanglement? Which is Devahuti's question back in chapter 25. Or undue affinity for matter, undue attachment to family life, undue attachment to fruitive activities, the stain that doesn't go away. No matter how much you bleach it, it stays. Indelibly, it stays. So, there's a cultivation element, and the cultivation element effectiveness depends upon the clarity of consciousness behind the activity. So there's this mixed area, zone, and then the cultivation part, depending upon the attentiveness, not just to the activity and how expertly you execute the activity, but the spirit of devotion behind the activity. Attentiveness must go there. And with that comes detachment. So going back, just in this verse, the word buddhi is used. Those who are intelligent, dhīra is the Sanskrit word here, previously is buddhi. But in order to be dhīra, one of you three boys, do you know what the word dhīra means? Can you give an English equivalent of dhīra? D-H-I-R-A. Dhīra. Dhīras tatra namuyati. You know that verse from Bhagavad Gita? Dhīra means literally, well, one way of translating it is sober, or undisturbed. It's in chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita. The yogi remains fixed in his meditation, dhīra. So even when there's cause for disturbance, he remains undisturbed. The example is given of rivers that pour into the ocean. Although they're pouring into the ocean isn't disturbed by the rivers pouring into the ocean because it's an ocean. So the mind that's fixed upon the Supreme remains undisturbed even there's provocation. Something provokes the mind. Somebody says something mean. Or it can go the other way. Somebody says something very complimentary. And dhira is one, the mind doesn't move. The mind is unwavering. Dhira. Like observing Pandava near Jalakadasi, we just did that. So dhira is not just thinking, oh my goodness, Pandava near Jalakadasi, or you're in the middle of observing Pandava near Jalakadasi and thinking, you know, Jim, I'm thirsty. If you one is absorbed, the benefit of such things is it gives an opportunity to be absorbed in hearing and chanting. So less activity, less attention to body and bodily necessities and impulses from the senses. Instead, focus on hearing and chanting. Extra japa, extra reading of scripture, and hearing of in various forms. And then that, because it's an auspicious day, especially auspicious day, the sweetness and the spiritual connection is even stronger. So you just rise above those, whatever it is, impulses born of the modes of nature and the senses wanting this and that. By higher taste, pram drishtva nivartate. So that's dhira. So one whose life is directed by that spiritual intelligence. Let me go to the spiritual side. Whatever my embodied condition is, it may be this or that, maybe a young boy, maybe an old man, it may be a woman, maybe a small child, it may be whatever it may be. I may be in school, I may be home for vacation, but home for vacation doesn't mean party time, it means I'm going to do activities. Now I have more opportunity to do these hearing and chanting and devotional activities. And refresh the spiritual substance within. That's intelligence. So guided by intelligence, even when doing routine work of day to day, going to work or taking care of the household or going to school or doing some homework or whatever are those various activities that our stage of life requires of us. Not for sense gratification or from gaining something, but for the purpose of making some offering to Krishna. Then that's the remedy for our implication in matter. One more verse. Oh, I read the verse. Here's the next verse, yeah. Text 6. By executing one's occupational duties, acting with detachment, and without a sense of proprietorship or false egoism, one is posted in one's constitutional position by dint of complete purification of consciousness, and thus, by executing so-called material duties, he can easily enter into the kingdom of God. The Sanskrit phrase is nivritti dharma. Nivritti. Prabhupada speaks of this in the early verses of the Bhagavatam. There are two paths of recommended within the Vedas. The first is pravritti and the second is nivritti. The pravritti marg is karmakanda. it's put in simple language, progressive absorption and elevation in refined matter. You know, going to, in this life and in the next life, attaining heaven. The path of progressive material enjoyment, pravritti. And this Bhagavatam is indicating nivritti. Nivritti means progressive diminishing, progressively diminishing implication in matter or involvement in matter. It's like anartha nivritti, the eradication of anarthas. Nivritti marg is progressively diminishing, or nivritti here, nivritti dharma, progressively diminishing one's interest in finding happiness through fruitive activities. Nivritti dharma. In the spirit of detachment, performing duties without a sense of proprietorship. That's the, you know, I and mine, aham and mama, the mine, what is mine flows from me. If I think in terms of the body as the self, then what's mine is what's produced from the body. Very logical. And so my family, my bank balance, my house, my bank account, my bills, my cell phone, that's mine. So that's the sense of proprietorship. Without the false sense of proprietorship, that is, things belong to Krishna, and we may be utilizing them for some time, and then we won't be utilizing them because we'll be gone. So we're utilizing Krishna's property in service to Krishna. And so without sense of proprietorship and without false ego, that false ego is identification, misidentification with the body. One is posted in one's constitutional position by dint of complete purification of consciousness. So the purification of consciousness is the hearing and chanting, and then the duties are born of our psychophysical nature, guna and karma. So we do our duties in a theistic way without attachment and cultivate hearing and chanting. That's the purified consciousness part. That's Bhagavad Dharma. And by thus executing so-called material duties, he can easily enter into the kingdom of God. Purport. Short purport. Here the word nivritti dharma nirata means constantly engaging in executing religious activities for detachment, unquote. There are two kinds, oh here we go, two kinds of religious performances, pravritti, which means the religious activities performed by the Grihamedis for elevation to higher planets, or for economic prosperity, the final aim of which is sense gratification. Dharma, artha, kama. Every one of us who has come to this material world has this sense of overlordship. This is called pravritti. But the opposite type of religious performance, which is called nivritti, is to act for the Supreme Personality of Godhead, engage in devotional service and Krishna consciousness. One has no proprietorship claim, nor is one situated in the false egoism of thinking that he is God or the Master. He always thinks himself the servant. That is the process of purifying consciousness. With pure consciousness, only can one enter into the kingdom of God. And the last sentence. Materialistic persons, in their elevated condition, can enter any one of the planets within this material world, but all are subjected to dissolution over and over again. Bhutva, bhutva, praliyate. Bhagavad Gita. Sounds like a Bhagavad Gita class. These verses are being presented in that way. The performance of duty in the spirit of detachment for purifying consciousness, and of course in the association of devotees and in the association of sadhus to engage in doing what sadhus do. Sadhu sangha results in bhajana kriya. So taking shelter in the hearing and chanting activities while engaging in prescribed duties suited for our position. The embodiment that we have. Kind of a little summary. Bhakti requires a degree of detachment, not a fanatical, artificial renunciation, but a degree of detachment, specifically detachment from sense gratification. There's a very famous verse that was composed by Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya to describe Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. It's found in Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya says or writes, Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga. Lord Chaitanya was teaching Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga. He was teaching devotional service performed with knowledge that carries with it a degree of detachment. Vairagya Vidya Nija Bhakti Yoga. Shikshartam Ekam Purushak Puranam, etc. So, Bhagavat Dharma, it requires a degree of detachment. Bhagavat Dharma requires a degree of detachment. It starts from the very, very beginning of the Bhagavatam. Dharma prodita kaita votra paramo nirmatsaranam satam. This Srimad Bhagavatam will not indulge in kaitava dharma. Kaitava dharma means dharma that's compromised, or Prabhupada called it cheating religion. Cheating religion is the pravritti where the real purpose of life, and the real purpose of the Vedas, is to take one back to Godhead. But instead, see, it's like asking which way to the gas station. They say that way when it's that way. We've been through that. You know, which way to get to such and such street? And you ask three people and they point in different directions. GPS gets it wrong many times too. So, thinking of a GPS story. We were trying to get to a program and it kept taking us around the block, you know, turn left at a street that didn't exist. And then, you know, we kept going and then said, recalculating, take us around the block and once again turn left at a street that didn't exist. It's a cheating GPS. So there's cheating religion that says go that away, and go that away takes you away from the goal of life. It's in certain terms, it's what Narada said to Vyasa about this abundance of karmakanda information, which is true. One can get this if you do that. It's not wrong. But it's not really what the purpose of the Vedas is. You give an inordinate emphasis to this, and therefore people who are already inclined to fruit activities are going to think, it's bona fide. Vyasa Dev gave it to us. It's cool. So you haven't sufficiently emphasized. So the Bhagavatam is, perhaps one can say, overemphasizing the other direction. The other direction is simply taking shelter of the personality of Godhead. But it's not in this abdication mood, it's in the as is appropriate for an individual, according to suitability message. That kind of detachment. So the involvement, it's subtle. The involvement is, let this be offered to Krishna consciousness. And we cultivate that it be offered to Krishna consciousness according to suitability for one's individual position, always moving the fulcrum in that direction, striving to at least move in that direction. Mothers are used to noise that children make, and others are not. If this noise continues, you just take your child to another place. Yeah? She's just being a little girl. There's nothing wrong with being a little girl. But for the rest of us, it's distraction. Mothers like to hear. So they bring their children so they can hear. And the children take the attention away from those who wish to hear without children's noise. That's classic. Okay, so any discussion? Bhagavad Gita 101. Yes. Say it again. Bhakti, that renunciation is not an anga of bhakti?
Is it an anga of bhakti?
Well, I would like to see the context of what he said. I can have one sense of perhaps what he meant when he said that. It means it's integral element of bhakti. It's not over here is this is a part and that's a part and that's a part, but it's intrinsic within bhakti. That is to say, for bhakti to grow, because bhakti is dynamic, then implicit, essential within it is bhakti. So something similar to the verse in the Canto 1, Chapter 2 section, where when one performs Vasudeva Bhagavati Bhakti Yoga Prayojataha Jani Ati Ashu Vairagyam Gyanam Chaya Dahaitukam, knowledge and detachment arise naturally when bhakti is present. So it's not, in that sense, it's not an anga of bhakti, it's a byproduct of bhakti. It's like, you know, It's part of bhakti.
Like a symptom.
It's of its nature, as opposed to it's one of its parts. Yes.
Maharaj, actually, Krishna explains in Gita this mind and intelligence on Bhumira Panlo, they're all, you know, these energies external. How to make sure that, of course, mind is definitely the external energy, but you know, mind should be purified, in other words, intelligence should be sharp enough so that they can make proper decisions. But we hear it is said intelligence is also the part of, you know, Krishna's energy. And then, I'm thinking external energy. So in other words, both are part of Maya, then how to make sure that my decisions are not impelled by Maya rather than impelled by Paramatma?
Somebody asked this question yesterday in a slightly different way. How do I understand something like this? How do I understand that when I'm getting this signal, that it's signal from Krishna and not a signal from my mind? It's a different way. Similar. Yeah, similar. You asked that question, right?
I did.
Who did? You did, okay. The answer that I gave then was, it's pretty safe to assume we're in a mixed position. There's some bhakti that's operating, and there's some non-bhakti that's operating, some conditioning that's operating. Safe to assume it. So now I've got this, using your context, you know, I have to make a decision, I have to apply my intelligence. How do I know it's not, you know, covered, and the material element, material intelligence operating, and instead it's spiritual intelligence operating? It's an indication from Krishna how to move forward with this circumstance I have to make the decision about. You know, Guru Sadhu Shastra. With the assumption that I'm in this mixed position. There's some of this and there's some of that. And I have to make a decision. So I make my best effort to consider what the scriptural indication is. I consult with saintly people, sadhus, detached persons who aren't conflicted with, you know, the same, at least the same set of notions that I have about this subject matter. I remember Prabhupada saying, it wasn't something he said many times, but something at least I heard once, that you consult five Brahmins. You know, detached persons that have scriptural foundation, that have, they're in touch with transcendence, and seek their input. In some, this, you know, depends on the nature of the decision, how serious and broad, far-reaching such a decision is. You know, then the mind can, and false ego can trick us. Well, I'll select the five Brahmins that I know are going to say what I want. So, I can say this from leadership and management. One of the advices given is, this is a Braj Bihari, and it's a Gopal Bhatta message, but it's good to pick some that are liberal, some that are conservative, and some that are moderate. Some that can see both perspectives. You involve those persons in contemplating something, some decision that needs to be made. Not just one side or just the other side. And be sufficiently detached to see, to allow, to encourage that the prevailing wisdom of Krishna will prevail. You know, still there's this tendency to lean this way or lean that way. But it, let go of that, and so again, it depends on the particular decision that needs to be made, the nature of it. Yeah. There's other kinds of criterion besides liberal, conservative, and moderate. I mean, on the one hand, people that have sufficient knowledge of a situation are good persons to consult. On the other hand, persons that may not know all the implications and particulars of the situation, therefore less informed, but wise and experienced and therefore detached. Now, selecting the right persons to seek counsel depending upon the nature of the decision, it's important. I'll share one from a GBC, and my thoughts are going to my GBC service from your question. One of the requirements of our present leadership is to pass on to the next generation of future leaders some fundamental, we're calling it foundational documents. So one of them is, what did Prabhupada mean about the ultimate managing authority? So one can go over this side, one can go over that side, but what did he mean? And it, you know, take step back from that one. And this is just sharing some GBC stuff. But there's, in our strategic planning that started in 2007, a committee was formed called Organization Development Committee that said, let's sit back and think about ISKCON 50 years from now. What's it going to look like? Will we have the same number of centers or more centers? We have more centers. Will ISKCON just be existing in the same cities and the same parts of countries that they now exist, or there'll be more, wider spread? Well, what should be the structure for governance for that? Do we start increasing the number of GBCs so we have, you know, like a football stadium where we have our meetings, or do we keep it down? And if we're going to keep it down, what's the number, and how are we going to oversee all these things? So those kinds of questions. So another one of those kinds of questions is, diversity is proliferating. That's good. As we're growing, more diversity. How to maintain unity with all that diversity. It's another wonderful topic. Wonderful topic. Then another is, we're celebrating ISKCON 50. What needs to be done today in terms of organization development to ensure that we have ISKCON 100? What should we do today to make sure that happens 50 years from now? That's a nice question. So one devotee named Gaurakrishna, that is Russian speaking, and he's learning more to speak English, and it's a little difficult to understand because he's not so fluent, but he spent 3 years studying which organizations, primarily religious but others, survive 100 years, and which ones don't, and why. 3 years. So he studied Islam, and then there are traditions within Islam that survived and some that didn't. Traditions within Catholicism that survived and didn't, etc. Very, very detailed. He's brilliant. And it got distilled down to what's called four generations. So I'm sharing this with you. It's directly connected to your question. So imagine a chart that shows there's four columns, and the first generation, and then horizontally, second generation, third generation, and fourth generation. So first generation is during the presence of the founder, like during the life of Muhammad. There's four boxes, four columns. there's issues, there's teachings, there's context, and there's intention. So the second generation, the intention of the founder of a religious organization is less clear, like, you know, let's say within ISKCON, Prabhupada disciples. The context to some degree is available. How did Prabhupada deal with issues? Sometimes this and sometimes that. You know, issues such as clash between renunciates and grihasthas, the Radha Damodar party, and, you know, temples versus traveling parties, and, you know, and etc. etc. So there was an intention of the founder, and there's a context for those situations, and there's teachings, and then there's the issues. So the next generation is less in touch with some degree, but less in touch with the intention, and a little bit more the historical perspective on context, and then his teachings, and then the issues, they still remain. The third generation loses the same degree of touch with the context, but then they have their teachings. So in his study, Muhammad emphasized teachings. He didn't want the stories of, you know, contextual, he said this, did this, in these circumstances. He wanted the teachings. Because, you know, he wanted the teachings. And so our present generation, the third generation, meaning not just Prabhupada and the followers, immediate disciples of Prabhupada, but the next generation, strong emphasis on teachings, starting, and then there's priorities of teachings, is books. But then there's other forms of teachings, this and that and the other. But it's, you know, lectures. And then less than that, because that's public, then less than that is room conversations and morning walk conversations, and then letters. And it's very, we don't know the letter that was written to Prabhupada, we know what his reply was, at least some of them. We don't know, then they have to piece together the context. But there's teachings. They'll help us to understand how to deal with issues. The next generation is the teachings. If the teachings diminish, all you have left is issues. So this generation, very, very, very strong emphasis on what were Prabhupada's teachings. Now, specific to what does the ultimate managing authority mean? We need a foundational document so the next generation knows what it means and the generations to follow. You know, that some, then on that issue, some say this and some say that. You know, pizza and pakoras, liberals and conservatives, and then the moderates. So to have such a discussion, we need to involve people that are, you know, they have the big picture, not just their quotes that support this or their quotes that support that, because that goes on. But what's, you know, what's the big body of teaching? And then to refine it, so they have diverse people, like, to articulate for generations to come, what does it mean? Because without the Prabhupada said, without the GBC, ISKCON wouldn't continue. He gave such importance to it. What does it mean? And then once you know what it means, then you can apply it. Because there are different contexts. It may mean this in this context and that in that context, but you need to know the meaning. And so it goes, that goes, feeds into what was the intention based upon the teachings. And then context. So this is a long-winded response to your question. It depends on the nature of the decision that needs to be made. And it's good to involve people that you can say have the big picture, but, you know, they may lean this way and some that lean that way and some that can see both sides, to be part of that dialogue of such an important decision. Now, you know, when you're doing the renovation work for the center, you don't need to involve a bunch of people. you need the right people, and then they collectively give their input, and somebody has to make decisions. Involve the right people in decision making. Not just so that, you know, people won't take pot shots afterwards, you did this instead of that. You're not going to please all the people. You have to make wise decisions. And it can be this or it can be that, but according to the wisdom Krishna has given, you take input and make some decisions. Depends on what the subject is. Most important, and out of all of this, is the wish that Krishna's will prevail. Now, when there's dissension, this side thinks, I just want Krishna's will to prevail, and that side thinks, I just want Krishna's will to prevail. And there's a clash. It happens. It's Kali Yuga. In the midst of all of that, we should not disrespect another person saying they don't really want Krishna's interest. They're bad. That's not nice. Sometimes that is the case, but you know that's you should be very careful in that territory. I think I've over-answered your question. Anything else? Yes.
Ryan, thank you for bringing out this study. I think we heard it in Gita Magri too.
Okay, you're going to hear it some more. I'll amplify. It's so important that at a midterm meeting of the GBC in Juhu, it's going to be a major message that's going to be placed before the GBC to contemplate. And at the Mayapur meeting, there's the third gathering of gurus, sannyasis, and GBC. It is going to be a major element of that discussion, because each of them are leaders, and leaders need to understand what we as leaders need to do to preserve ISKCON, so we can celebrate ISKCON 100, or at least you all can do that. We'll be gone. So it's real important, and how it's going to take shape is yet to be seen, but at least elevating that message from this nice devotee's 3 years of study. Brilliant. I mean, the details and details and details and details and details. Details. Go ahead.
My thoughts are leaning towards how can we effectively take Srila Prabhupada's the categories that are more towards teaching and then moving more towards context, and how can we properly apply them then? Instead of just ignoring, we don't ignore the letters and those things that are moving towards more context, but does the question make sense?
I think I know what you mean. Well, two things. If I've understood your question correctly, some members of our society need to become specialists in fields. They need to become deeply learned. And as an example, take Rabindranath Prabhu. He is given an assignment to write a foundational document on Prabhupada as the founder acharya. And what does that mean? He spent 3 years. And he read tons of stuff. He deeply, deeply, it's like, he did like doing a PhD thesis on Founder Acharya. It wasn't like a cosmetic, this is what I feel. He studied it and studied it and studied it in depth until he could get where those words come from and what did they mean to Bhaktisiddhanta and to Prabhupada. And because he went into that depth, he's now so gifted in explaining that principle. So we need such persons who have the capacity, the prowess, and the skill set to do that kind of work. And we need our general group of devotees who wish to see ISKCON 100 to broadly, so there's the specialized in-depth, and then there's the broad education part of not just, you know, reading Bhagavad Gita, but or taking Bhakti Shastri, but becoming, you know, deeply absorbed, immersed in the subject, so that you live it, and because you live it, you get all kinds of realizations, and then you can express it in your words and your deeds. That's what we need. Does that answer your question? Not exactly.
I was thinking more like...
For you personally.
Or, yeah, when we make use of Prabhupada's various categories.
Okay.
How can we prevent, like, the danger, per se, of moving more towards contextual based?
Okay. I'm sorry. I didn't touch on what you were asking. So... there's priority. What he wrote in his books is more important than the others. But if we take the teachings and how do you apply the teachings, then you start moving into the context. There's histories of Prabhupada's life. But, for example, I've been told those that have read Harisori's writings were present when such and such took place, and they perceived it in a very different way. But that's natural. It's human nature. We're sitting in the room and right now, and we're experiencing the same thing from a different perspective. You know, like, you know, little child making noise. We're experiencing from a different perspective. And if we were to retell what we experienced this morning, we would, you know, be there. You know, anyway, you get the idea. So then one need to be conversant in that this is this in-depth study part. So for you or for us, books are foundational. Go very deeply into them, not just its message, but the spirit of the message, and internalize that. Then go to the other sources, the room conversations and the letters and the other, and become very conversant. Each of us needs to do that. Not, you know, the brahmanas, but to a degree, that was the part that I was saying. Each of us needs to do that to some degree. To the degree that we wish to see ISKCON 100, we collectively have to do more of that than has been done by your superiors. Because your superiors have been very involved in, they had received directly teachings, and they have their own autobiography of what Prabhupada's intention was. And in the different contexts. We have to become deeply studied in all of these things, primarily based in his books, if we're going to get it right. And some things are more important than others. I mean, here's one. When should we observe our Vaishnava holiday? Should it be the calendar in Mayapur, or should it be according to local calculation? Prabhupada did it one way. And some persons came along afterwards and said, well, wait a minute. And they had their reasoning and did, you know, made their G-cal and then their V-cal, and with algorithm changes, and, you know, you calculate locally because, and they gave all their becauses. But it's complicated. So maybe you should just make it simple. Don't be over-intelligent. So that's an example. So do we find that Prabhupada adjusted things? Yes. And what were the circumstances where he adjusted things and didn't adjust things? We have to become knowledgeable. So we have to go not just to the books, but to those other sources. Otherwise, we're scratching our head. And you scratch your head, and then some people are going to build a case for this side, some people can build a case for that side, start hitting each other. You know, at least over email or Facebook or something. So we need to do this. And you know, it needs to be thorough. There's so many things like this. I'll throw one out just because it's been in my face for the past while. Somebody somewhere, temple president, said, we have Sri Vaishnavas in our community. They would like to cook when we have festivals. Can they cook when we have festivals? They're initiated in Sri Vaishnav tradition. So I asked two people, Revati Raman, because he's in Tirupati and he's involved with Sri Vaishnavas. And then I asked our deity worship minister, Jayananda. I got two different answers. And then they passed it on to Brahma Muhurta, who gave this detailed answer that was basically no. And then I forwarded that to Gaura Keshava, and he said yes. And that just has to do with, you know, our tradition, their tradition, Gaudiya Vaishnava standards and Gaudiya Vaishnava standards, and, you know, was Prabhupada accepting of other standards besides our own Gaudiya Vaishnava standards as long as they were being properly followed? And it gets into all this, really, you know, the Gopal mantra and the Kam Gayatri mantra, and Sri Vaishnavas don't have those, and is it necessary to have those particular mantras in order to do deity worship or cook? Or is it sufficient if they're initiated over there and they're chanting 16 rounds and Harinam is sufficient? So you can just throw your hand up in the air and say, you know, don't bother me. Well, what should we do? Well, you know, one saying is better to be safe than sorry. So no. We want to be safe. But what was the intention of our founder Acharya? Then you have to do all this study. So aside from that tradition versus this tradition, what did our founder Acharya do? How did he adjust things? Did he adjust things? Yes. What were the standards and conditions under which he adjusted? So there has to be some understanding of context and intention. And discerning intention from context requires pure consciousness, because otherwise, back to, you know, this other question, we'll be operating with our own preferences rather than the preferences or the intention of our founder. There's no substitute for Krishna consciousness. And there's other issues. Too many. Anything else? Yes?
In the Vedic society, the occupational duties and, I mean, certain the roles that people played were much more defined
yes.
than one would see today.
Yes.
And so I was wondering, if you can comment on, you know, how does one find priority in the multiple roles that we play? Because you can have an, you know, you can be doing something occupationally, plus you've got roles, you know, as a
socially,
as a child, as a mother, as a
community member.
Right. And so how does one go about finding, you know, a little more clarity in terms of, you know, what are the priorities and how does... how to try to balance all that to please the Lord?
Well, it's a similar question to what Yuga Kishore asked. How do we decide? when we have to make a decision. So you're referring to a particular category of decision, guru, sadhu, shastra, and proper guidance. So someone that you feel, they represent the teachings of our beloved founder Acharya by their personal example. They may be a grahastha, they may be a sannyasi, they may be this, they may be that. They're exemplary. They're deeply rooted in the tradition and its teachings. Now there are persons who are in that category. Some are more traditional, some are more flexible. Right. Now then there's you, or each one of us, you know, in our diverse society. So someone that you feel not just resonates with your being more liberal or more traditional, naturally will go for that which is more like us, naturally. Naturally. But if the intention is, I want to be in fidelity with our founder Acharya, and our founder Acharya was flexible, and he was also traditional. So strengthen your relationship with your founder Acharya by reading his teachings with the intention of, I want to receive from him his message, and let that touch your heart. And then take guide, then having done that, or while doing that, seek guidance and be ready to, you know, accept the guidance that you received, especially when you feel, this is a person that I have trust and confidence in, they're trustworthy, and they'll guide me carefully. They'll also understand my nature, not only theirs. And they'll guide me. And then I'll, you know, what I'm saying here is from Canto 1, Chapter 9, Grandfather Bhishma speaking to Maharaj Yudhisthira, pacifying Maharaj Yudhisthira. And he says, there's three elements. He says, when you do activity, make sure that there's three things. It's within the codes of Dharma. Two, you apply those principles of Dharma under the guidance of a qualified Vaishnava or Brahmana. And three, that you do those things with the intention of trying to please Krishna. When you live your life that way, you don't need to worry about the consequences because you're rightly situated. So you may go more on the traditional, and may go more on the conventional or flexible side. And there's a range, but follow those three principles. And if you're submissive to what wanting to please Krishna, if Krishna taps you on the shoulder and says you're headed in the wrong direction, then you're submissive to Krishna's indication. You're eager for that. But it may be a gentle indication. It may be a slam in the head indication. But you're submissive to Krishna's indication because that's what your intention is. And Krishna will guide you. Dadami buddhi yogam tam yena mam opiyanti te. Krishna will give the buddhi how to come to him. Follow those principles.
Could you repeat those principles?
Huh?
Could you repeat those?
The three?
Yes.
I'll look it up later to send you the exact verse, but the three are, follow the codes of Dharma under the guidance of a qualified Vaishnava or Brahmana with the intention of pleasing the Supreme Lord. Then you need not worry with the outcome. That's in Krishna's hand. I say it this way. Ours is the service department. Results is Krishna's department. We don't try to do Krishna's service. We try to do our service. Okay, I think I'm going to end. Thank you very much. Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Yeah.